I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. This episode, I'm going to talk about the recently released HBO documentary, 40 Years a Prisoner. Before I get into today's topic, which I've talked about before, I do want to talk about something, a short that was on Netflix that I found out really randomly. And to be honest with you, I found out about it through Black Twitter, which is where I found out about most things. I was just perusing Black Twitter as you do and interacting and things like that, just in between a downtime, between doing a project at work and following up on something related to the sorority and Greek life and all that stuff. And I distinctly remember the tweet that I saw was, please go watch this highly underrated gem on Netflix. It was dropped a couple of days ago and it had no promotion whatsoever. And everybody knows, like, for as much as Netflix tries to play like they're all inclusive and they try to push out the same energy on all of their projects, what we know is that, I mean, they're no different than Amazon. They're no different than just about any major streaming service. Excuse me, that was me suppressing a yawn. We have examples like Amazon Prime released Fast Color with little to no fanfare whatsoever. Fast Color was released in films or in theaters last year with little to no fanfare, and there was a wonder why nobody watched it. It's because few people knew about it or saw the previews for it until like the week of, for the most part. I know I didn't see any previews for it for real until the week of, and that was on social media, primarily Twitter. But there are more. Netflix had, Always a Witch. That's the one. Let's just stick to Netflix for now. So remember, you might not remember Always a Witch, but there was a lot of hand-wringing and fast Twitter fingers behind the fact that Always a Witch, and I think the title is in Spanish. Like, when it was first released, it was a Spanish title. It was a Spanish language title, but then they might have switched it to say Always a Witch. And anyway, the criticism was that the marketing was all wrong and it wasn't nearly enough for this predominantly black and brown production. But yet, like, the millionth Adam Sandler film gets all the promotion, gets front page and all of that stuff. You know how it is when you log into your, when you log into Twitter or when you log into, Amazon Prime and, whatever hot new thing they want to push is on your front page, right? Regardless of whether or not that actually matches with something you would typically watch, it's still going to be on your front page. And the criticism was that they might have done that the day it was released, but that it wasn't nearly enough as the umpteen thousandth Adam Sandler movie that they push and promote. And then there have been others. What was that predominantly Latinx cast of One Day at a Time? Was it One Day at a Time? It was a predominantly Latinx cast of One Day at a Time that they canceled after two seasons. And it was, again, one of those things where, so you will keep, basically the criticism has been for black and brown shows, well, just non-white shows, if we really want to go there, that you put energy on what you want to promote. And just because you, like, you put real energy in promoting the things that you want to get, generate a lot of eyeballs on. And if you truly wanted, if you truly wanted these shows and these movies to succeed, that you would give them more energy. And that was, has been the criticism. And so once again, so the reason why this tweet caught my eye was because I agreed. Like, again, Always a Witch. I promise you, I didn't remember seeing anything until like it was released, and then nothing, like not much. And I'll give you an example of something. Was it Sensual 8? What was it? Sense 8? Whatever, that supernatural, superpower, sci-fi thing where all of these 8 different people were connected, even though they weren't on the same continent, even though, they were in the same time, but they just weren't in the same space. But they were all interconnected. I can remember that having months of lead time. Even Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Even Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, that movie that's coming out with Chadwick Boseman, his last film. I cannot remember her name. Viola Davis. Viola Davis is Ma Rainey. I first saw a promotion about that thing a couple of months ago, like September, perhaps. Now, mind you, I had been hearing about it before, largely because it was related, you know, it was Chadwick's last film. And so, you'd be talking about it, but for Chadwick losing his battle with cancer, I wonder if they would have been talking about it the way they were talking about it. Probably not, though. Who knows? But Netflix has a history of not really putting out a lot of energy to promote predominantly non-white cast or non-white programming, despite all of its efforts, you know, with that Twitter account talking about strong black lead or whatever. Despite all of that, and I think that actually sprung from criticism of them not doing enough to promote it sprung out of this desire for them to do more. And despite that, there's still criticism that lingers out there of them not really truly promoting things or ending, terminating successful black and brown shows that, for whatever reason. And again, it's hard to challenge Netflix when they say it just wasn't getting the streams, when they don't tell you how many streams these movies and shows get, right? So when they canceled One Day at a Time, folks were like, what are you talking about? Everybody that I know watches it. Everybody that I know watches this show, yet you're canceling it. And then I think that the rationale they gave was that, it just wasn't getting the streams that it needed. But you don't talk about your streams. You don't talk about that. What you talk about is the budget. Netflix mostly just talks about the budget. Unless I'm missing something, when a thing is released, Netflix is real guarded about how many people are watching it. And so, like, there's no real transparency there. It's kind of like that fake transparency, right? Where they tell you how much a thing is and they tell you, you know, what they expect it to do, but they don't tell you what it did. You know what I mean? In terms of numbers, in terms of, and the number that counts in this instance is how many people watched it. So blah, blah, blah. Long story short, you know, we side-eye Netflix. I certainly side-eye Netflix because you're not different. Just because you have a whole Twitter account that's talking about strong black lead and all of this stuff, and you're trying to work really hard to, you know, get more content that is brown, non-white, predominantly not, or featuring casts that are not predominantly white, you know, you're still a streaming service who could do whatever you want. And so, yeah, you kind of side at them. And so anyway, and again, I put them in the same category as Amazon. Amazon, for every one film that they have on there, it feels like for every one film that they have on there that is a predominantly Asian cast or in the Asian diaspora, or Black cast or in the Black diaspora, or Latinx cast or in the Latinx diaspora, Pacific Islander, what have you, there's like 85,000. It feels like there's 85,000 predominantly white cast. Like, it just never, and their cover pages, it's hilarious how whitewashed their cover pages are. Let's just be real. When I'm saying cover pages, what I'm really saying is the shows that they feature, the movies and shows that they feature. And it just never fails. Like, they always have the lone white guy who's always got to start, who's always got to be Captain Save-A-Ho, right? He's our only hope, or he's the only one that's true in this whole thing. Or a diabolical white woman, right? Who's like, she's bad, but she's so good. And then you have the random, like, the Black guy in there, because the Black guy represents Black, because that's all that it can be. Like, or you have the brown guy, like, sometimes it's Latinx. Actually, yeah, no, they do a decent job of trading off the brownness of the love interest or the intriguing, mysterious man. But honey, when it comes to diversity of the cast, it's like laughable. Let's be real. And again, I don't necessarily, I didn't say this, I don't blame it on the actors so much as I just blame it on the production company and production and Amazon itself, the studio. Anyway, so I said all that to say, yeah, there's a whole lot left to be desired between these big streaming services, especially Netflix, who's been doing this, took the world by storm, essentially, by introducing this concept, which in and of itself would open up a whole huge opportunity for a whole lot of different producers, filmmakers, actors, right? Or at least it should, right? But we still have to fight to make sure that the representation is there, and that you're giving these movies and shows a chance, right? And so anyway, back to the tweet. And if you're new to this show, I ramble. Welcome. I eventually get back to the point, but you might just want to, you know, be doing another thing, you know, do a task or what have you, until I get back to the point, because it's just me. Thank you for listening all the same. Anyway, so yeah, back to my point. So I see the tweet, and did it mention? Yeah, it did. In the tweet, it did mention the name of the thing that I was supposed to be watching, that you should be giving it a chance. And they did also mention that it was animated. And I think initially, so I read the tweet, watched this super under, oh, this is how I got to the tweet. So I saw this animated picture of, it's clearly like Pixar style, or it was high quality animation, I'll say, of a Black man who was clearly a barber, who looked like what a typical barber would look like, right? He had the high top fade, which is not a typical look, but what I'm saying is he looked like what you might see, a man you might see cutting somebody's hair in any given Black barbershop. So he had a high top fade. No, it wasn't a high top fade. It was just a fade. And he had a very big, look like big moisturized freeway beard. And he had it was showing him at work. So he was behind the, so he had somebody in his chair and he was cutting the hair. And I can't remember if he had scissors or clippers, but anyway, I just remember his forearm. I remember it clearly looking like he was at his station with somebody in his chair with a, you know, barber cape on. And he looked like he was in mid-sentence talking about something, and that his forearm very distinctly had tattoos on it. And I'm just thinking, you know, in and of itself, that was remarkable, because it looked so realistic. It was like a cartoon, but it looked so realistic, down to the detail of the tattoos that would probably most definitely be on the forearm of your neighborhood barber. Anyway, but the thing that really drew my eye was that there was a caption. You know how you can retweet a thing, retweet a picture? So somebody had retweeted a picture of this particular picture and said, "I would like to speak to the animator." And then if you looked at the image of the man who retweeted, or the person that retweeted the image and made the comment, had an uncanny resemblance to the man in the animation. And I'm just like, ah, see there? I bet he'll bob too. Anyway, so initially I was looking at that. And then in the comments, people were just cracking up. And then the guy, the original poster, you know, it had like 3.5 million people liked it, or whatever, or 1,000 people liked it or whatever. And so the commenter, you know how they do when something quote unquote blows up, the commenter always goes back and makes another comment on it, referencing how many people have really enjoyed it. And usually they promote something else or whatever. And anyway, and usually, and I don't know how this works other than maybe you edit your original post and you add onto it. And so that's how it's your top post. It is the top post for the tweet. But anyway, so the poster, you know, mentioned that it's very funny that the comments that are in the mentions of the original tweet range from being thirsty, like thirsty, I want you in my bed sort of tweets, to emotional representation matters tweets, which is very weird. But, you know, nevertheless, that's what Twitter is. If not, anyway, Twitter is a thirsty, social justice-y, hateful place. And so anyway, so I was reading those comments and I was laughing at that and laughing at the poster, the original poster. And then I saw someone, generally speaking, talking about the animation, because everybody was commenting how great the animation was and how the character that was, that everybody was looking at that was in that still literally looked like somebody we could all know. Like your neighborhood barber. Anyway, so somebody, eventually I got to the comment where somebody said, Netflix is doing it again. And here's this animation that has got zero promotion. And it's on Netflix and we gotta support. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the animator who made the barber that everybody was talking about, that the poster had commented that he would like to speak with them, was the animator of this show that was not getting any play, right? Not getting any support from Netflix, despite it streaming on Netflix. And so I instantly, you know, I read the title, and the title of the film, the animated film, was The Canvas. And so I was like, okay, bet. Well, let me go find it on Netflix. So I made light work of it. It instantly left the app and went to Netflix. And sure enough, I put it in there and it popped up right away. So I began to watch it, or I clicked on it to start watching it. And the first thing I noticed was that, oh, it is 8 minutes long. It's like 8 minutes, eight or nine. It's like 8:15 or 9:15 minutes, 9 minutes and 15 seconds at the most. Long. And I was like, oh shoot. I didn't know that Netflix did like minis, like short shorts like this. I didn't know. So anyway, so I began to watch it, and it's super cute. And long story short, it's just great animation. It centers around this senior black man who lives in his own home. It's clear that he's lost his wife, not super recently, but it's not been long. It may not. You get the sense that probably it hasn't been a full year, or if it has been a full year, it's been a hard year for this person. And anyway, it's the other thing that you get is that he watches his granddaughter in the daytime while his daughter assumingly goes to work or whatever. And so in this 9 minutes, you go on this journey of basically, you know, him. It's called the canvas. So he's a painter, or at least he painted, but he's had a hard year. And then, you know, you introduce your granddaughter, who's growing in interest. And his granddaughter in this little short appears to be no more than like 8 or 9, right? And so, being a granddaughter, you know, inquisitive and all of that stuff. And so clearly the moral of the story is your love and your family, just a good, kind relationship, if you're open, can help you heal and grow and not forget, but for you to move on. And it's, like I said, it's like 9 minutes and 15 seconds at the most. And it is gorgeous. And to be honest with you, it brought me to tears in one space, which I'm a crier, but like, I would think, I guess my whole point is that it's moving. It's 9 minutes and 15 seconds, but it's moving. And so I do encourage you to watch it. And I will put in the show notes, just as a little reminder that you do watch it. If nothing more, to boost this animator, because it's really good. It's the quality is really good, to the point where, so I told you the guy's a senior, right? So you know how you get age spots? You know how black, or skin tags, you know how black folks tend to get skin tags the older we get? And I know that this is probably across the diaspora, but I used to think it was just my family, but like, then I just recognized that it tends to be black folk. They get skin tags. Well, anyway, this particular senior, he has skin tags on his face, and there's a close-up at one point on his face, and you see the skin tags, and age spot skin tags, or whatever you want to call them. And it feels so real. And that is a detail that if you didn't study an old black person, you wouldn't know to put that detail there. You know what I mean? Like the way his beard, the curl of his beard is that it's Afro textured hair. So of course, if you didn't, what we typically see, and I know I'm not the first person to ever say this, I know it's a conversation we're having right now, and it's also part of the reason why everybody responded, including me, so positively to that tweet about that barber, was because the barber's hair was jet black, but you could see the moisture. Like, I could tell that his beard was juicy, because there's a certain way that moisturized black hair that has coils and definition, there's a certain way that the light reflects onto a well-moisturized beard or well-moisturized hair, or there's a certain way that the light responds to curly hair, even curly white hair that's Afro-textured. It's what it is. Like, it's just a fact. And if you don't study, if you're not paying attention to that detail, you're not going to get that detail, which is why, you know, depending on, like, if it's a non-black animator or an animator that is not paying attention to these details, you're going to get straight hair, as if it were straight hair, like someone who's not, like, you would miss the detail. Without sounding too more weird, because y'all probably think I'm weird. But I think it matters. I I've shared this before. Like, I'm done watching things that aren't including me, or aren't paying attention to the uniqueness of blackness, the very specific ways that we are across the culture, in terms of, you know, the things that would shape a person in New York to respond in a different way than somebody who grew up in Texas, or someone from the Caribbean to respond differently to someone who grew up in the UK. Like, there's similarities, but it's still different, right? And you need to understand that. There's context that you need to spend some time understanding, right? And it goes right down to how we wear our hair, how we look. Because the thing about it is, regardless, we don't This 9 minute and 15 second short, we don't hear a word. We hear sounds. We don't hear speech. And so we don't know the where this grandfather and the daughter and the granddaughter fit into in the diaspora. We just know that they're part of the black, the African diaspora, right? But what is true across the diaspora is the way our skin reflects in the sun, depending on your shade, the way our hair, the way the sunlight glits off of our skin is soft light, harsh, direct sunlight, how it reflects off of our hair. And that matters. And it is frustrating to me. It, not in a huge way, but it's confusing to me why we are just now getting animation that really looks like us is my point. And that's in video games, which I'm hearing that gamers are saying it's a big deal that some of these games in the last 3 years, some of these games have really stepped up their animation to look more realistic to what a black person in the diaspora would look like, depending on their background. So like the biggest one is Miles Morales, right? And so you get the coily texture or whatever, but what was really impressive is he had a fade. And like people were losing their mind over the fact that Miles Morales had a fade in the game. And the reality of it is black people been getting fades. Like black people have been a part of the gaming industry since the gaming industry, black people had got access to it in the 80s, 70s and 80s, right? So why there haven't been more realistic versions of black people is simply because animators haven't been paying attention. And so now that they are paying attention, it's a big deal. And I recognize it and I enjoy it. And again, something as simple as how the light reflects off of this old man's beard. Soft light. How, when you look at the close-up, he's got skin tags right underneath his eye, which if you pay attention to most black folks, many, I wouldn't say all, but many senior black folks, unless they've gotten them removed, have them right in the cheek area. And this man had it. And I noticed that detail and I enjoyed it. I think the only thing, and I could go back and look, I think the only thing that it didn't have was the blue age ring that I don't know if this is particular to black folks so much as it's just something that happens to an older eye. Like when you get into your 70s and 80s, more so probably your 80s, I would think, that you get this bluish ring around your eye. And I don't know if that's glaucoma or what, but there's a little blue that comes out in your iris. And I can't remember if that was present or it wasn't present. I think his eyes were just brown. And again, that could be a sign of glaucoma or whatever. So maybe you don't need to do that. But anyway, I just appreciated the animation. I appreciated the attention to detail. And so watch that when you have a chance. It's less than 10 minutes long. And then that it also includes the credits. So if you really want to go there, I think the animation itself is like 8 minutes and 30 seconds, something like that. So definitely watch that. So the other part of what I wanted to do, I know I spent like almost 30 minutes talking about animation, but it just moved me. That little clip, the little bit of animation moved me. So anyway, the topic that I want to talk about, or I intend to talk about today, is not necessarily a subject that I wanted to revisit, but when HBO, which does do a good job of marketing all of its programming, for the most part, it does a really great job, regardless of who the showrunners are, regardless of whether or not it takes it in a direction that makes sense for you. They do a good job of promoting their work because at the end of the day, they want eyeballs on their stuff. So anyway, 40 Years a Prisoner. I had seen a promotion of that. I'm gonna be honest with you. I had only seen a promotion of it within the last 3 weeks. I feel confident, though, that it's because I haven't been watching HBO like that. Lovecraft Country had gone off. Was there another show? I did not care for that movie with that show with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant. Just wasn't my cup of tea. Like, I tried to watch aspects of it, but I just didn't. And I know a lot of folks are talking about the black woman lawyer who was in it, and how good she was, but like, it didn't seem like something I wanted to watch. So I haven't been watching it for real. And so I haven't watched HBO in a minute, so I can't speak to how much. I guess I have been kind of watching the show about the guy whose mother was, the guy who's trying to figure out who took his mother's life. But I haven't been watching it in prime time. I've been watching it the next day in the morning or like at my lunch break or whatever. I haven't been watching it in real time to see the promotions leading up to the show for real. So I don't know how well they've been marketing the show, but these last 3 weeks, I've been in a place to be watching HBO in prime time, or at least having the show on in prime time. And then I was able to see the promotion for 40 Years a Prisoner. And so I'll go into more details in the next segment, but I thought it was important for me to watch this show because the movie that I had seen about the MOVE bombing, the 1985 police bombing of MOVE, that the MOVE organization is the main point, because there's a very specific phrase that describes them and I've forgotten it, and so I'm gonna go look it up between this segment and the next. But anyway, the documentary that I watched about them, just there wasn't any commentary for the most part. It was words on the screen and then cuts of the movie. It's cuts of different footage that was received or that was recorded. It didn't answer all my questions. It was clear that there was a particular, not a particular angle, but there was certain messaging that the director wanted to get out, the filmmaker wanted to get out. And that was fine, but I still had more questions than I had answers. And so I was eager to hear the perspective. I wanted to see HBO's spin on this because I tend to appreciate HBO's documentaries more. And so just because they put a lot of energy, it feels like they put a lot of energy into getting, not necessarily getting the story right, but getting more information on the table, or at the very least painting a bigger picture and maybe a clearer picture. Even if it's not answering all your questions, you still know more. So anyway, so that's why I watched it. And I'm actually glad I did watch it because I learned something, not what I wanted to know, but I learned something else that was important for me to know. And it put some more pieces into perspective. So anyway, I'm gonna hope to keep this show to an hour and 30 minutes. We'll see how that happens. That did not work last week, despite my best efforts. So anyway, in the next segment, I'm gonna talk about 40 Years, A Prisoner, which I thought was a movie about a different survivor, but it ended up being a survivor of the bombing that had a very unique perspective, and that with the fullness of time gives us just a snapshot into not only how devastating the bombing was, but its lasting impact on the community and specifically on this particular person's life. The three people's life, but specifically this one particular person's life. And so in the next segment, I'll go into all of that detail and then, you know, do my usual, give my perspective on it and stuff like that. So anyway, in the next segment, it's all about 40 Years a Prisoner. So let me get right into it. But first I do want to say that I am
For those of you who are new to this series or to the show, I am watching The Real Housewives of Potomac reunion. I just watched the part one, and I think that was the most entertaining thing and the most captivating thing that I've seen this season. I did not enjoy watching that fight. I've actually stopped watching the season after the fight when Monique and all the women came together, but Candace wasn't there and Monique was crying. I stopped it then because while I do take issue with Monique sometimes in her behavior was escalated and manipulated by Candace. Candace needs a lot of help and support and patience, and she needs to give that to herself. And she is a person that if we were in public, if she were in my own life, I would avoid her. I'm appreciating Karen more. I think, yeah, that's the thing that I will, the biggest takeaway so far for me is that I appreciate Karen more. Even though Karen is messy, I appreciate her journey more. I appreciate her evolution as a woman, or even if that's not her, totally her, right? Like she's putting on for TV. I appreciate her evolution from season one to now, because in her personal life, she's actually evolved. I can't tell if half of these women have truly evolved as a person so much as they've just, you know, moved and twisted and wriggled as a character, right, on the show. But like the one person that I honestly think has evolved is Karen. But again, I've always been kind of rooting for Karen, even though she was snooty patooty in the beginning, and I did not like that. I've always been rooting for her because she represents to me a shining example of a woman or of a person who even old and older in their life, even though she's not like super duper old, but you get what I mean, like older in life can still move and change and grow in her marriage and grow as in her own identity and grow as a mother and change and stuff. Like we got that visual representation, like we got to see it. And I love that. And I actually, she's my favorite. If there was a person, a favorite to choose, she would be my favorite, even though she's messy, even though I don't like the way she antagonizes Giselle, but I really don't like Giselle anymore. Anyway, I'm not going to talk more about that. But you know, maybe, we'll see. We'll see. I am looking forward to the rest of this this reunion because I've never seen a reunion in real time before. A Real Housewives of Potomac, a Real Housewives reunion in real time. I've always seen it months, years later. Not even months. Excuse me. Not even months. I only started watching the Real Housewives franchise for real like this year. So I've never seen it in real time. So it is interesting to see how Andy has everything set up. I really admire how he has these questions going and he's not throwing the Molotov cocktails. He asked direct questions that probably all of us were thinking. And then we get to watch these characters wriggle and squirm. And Giselle was wriggling and squirming, and so was Candace. And so was, Wendy, which girl, okay. I still don't understand her relevance to the show other than I don't understand her relevance to the show. Like, I appreciate that you're Nigerian American. I'm pretty sure not every Nigerian American offers you, a meal when they see you, girl. Like, come on, like moving on. Like that was cute for you, but like, I'm sure you represent a lot to a lot of people, but I don't know that folks are like, anyway, that's not my business. That's not my business. Anyway, Ashley girl, I'm glad you're a mom and that you are loving being a mom, but I don't really get her character. Like, I don't know why her character is relevant except to be mad. And I don't know. And then Monique, I don't know, but maybe it's not for me to know why these characters are on here. I just enjoy watching Karen. Yep, that's it. That's everybody else. Oh, shoot, I forgot Robin. I mean, hey, girl, like, I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, So yeah, anyway, but I'll be watching the other two parts, because it's gonna get juicy. I hate that Monique brought out that binder. I hate where it's gonna take everything. I hate that she's on attack mode, because she gets really nasty when she's in attack mode, but things have been nasty, right? Like, and I regret that whole narrative that Black women are not a monolith. You not representing, Giselle is hilarious, because if anything, she's representing the fool for me. Like, she's representing a fool of a woman for me, because she talks loud and she talking about she's super saved and all of this stuff. And she's first lady. Girl, get in line, clearly. Like, what's up? Like, for real? Like, she's one of those. I feel like maybe not every religious organization has one, but there's always this loud, and I don't want to paint her in that way, but there's always one person that thinks they are the arbiter of what is this standard of behavior, what is this person, what is this title. And girl, if you just scratch the surface, you'll recognize that it's a lot of puffery. That's what it is. A lot of it is puffery. And I feel like, girl, Giselle, come on. I don't know what's going on, but like, I hope it's the show and not you as a woman, because I want more for you, and I hope you want more for yourself too, because I don't know that this is what you wanted. But anyway, but I'm watching it, and I'm excited. So moving on. All right, but we're talking about 40 Years a Prisoner. And I guess the main thing for me, and I think I said this in the intro, and shout out to anybody who's listening to this podcast for the first time. I record this, typically I record my episodes in parts. So I sometimes remember what I was talking about in the intro. Sometimes I don't. So I repeat myself. So just roll with it, flow with me. Okay. Anyway, but yeah, so 40 Years a Prisoner is a documentary, just like Let the Fire Burn was a documentary. Let the Fire Burn, I talked all about the contents of Let the Fire Burn, and definitely the police, the Philly PD bombing of the MOVE organization in Philly in 1985, that led to the leveling of like two or three city blocks because of a fire that erupted that was allowed to burn by the Philly Fire Department back then, which it wasn't. There was a huge inquest into it, and I talk about it in the episode that I think I entitled the Philly PD bombing of MOVE. And I think I might have done that in April of this year, April or May of this year. So go back and look, because I was also talking about, I think I was inspired to talk about the bombing largely because it was the anniversary. But I also talked about Waco, and I think I was interested in just police involvement and their reaction to their overreaction. Police and police-like agencies and their reaction to organizations that for by and large were separatist groups, which in separatist in and of itself is not necessarily racist unless I'm using the term wrong. But many of the groups that identify themselves as being a separatist group tend to be white separatists, right? And we have many examples of that, especially in the early 90s. The FBI was going after a ton of them. Even though the Branch Davidians weren't a white separatist group, they were definitely separatists, separating themselves from the culture, which in a lot of these groups, you know, removing themselves from the culture, removing themselves from the authority, not recognizing the authority of the United States government, regardless of what is driving them. I think the through line between many of them, and I am not a sociologist, so please, I'm not a sociologist at all. I do enjoy sociology, but I'm not a sociologist. Did not go to school for that. Did not get my degree in that. But I think what I noticed that, well, not that I noticed, let me remove myself. What seems evident when I look at this information, even though I said, there I go, I again, but yeah, I'm putting it back on me, is that they're all recognizing the United States government to be a corrupt machine manipulating its subjects, as it were, which is us. And I don't know that I want to go there. I know that our system was built with flaws. And so as a result, we're going to continue to reap the benefits, however nasty, of those flaws, which is, you know, ballooning, skyrocketing rate of incarceration of Black and brown people to further fuel the prison industrial complex and all of that stuff, right? Like, there's a whole bunch of nasty side effects that come with the flaws that were built into the system, right? Policing in itself. The idea that you could take a regular person, give them a gun, and expect them not to be emotionally, to make emotional decisions. Like, that's an oxymoron. We're emotional beings. So somebody gonna do something when they're mad. Like, and the idea that a person would be above their own personal feelings and not react out of anger and not abuse their power is naive and has been what we've been basing our criminal justice system on for the longest. What we know is that sometimes judges, sometimes because somebody doesn't address them appropriately, will tack on extra days in jail or tack on a larger amount of in a fine because of how they felt, because they felt, you know, that they didn't treat them with the right, they didn't, you know, they didn't call them by the right title, or they didn't say yes. I was reading a story where a woman, where was it in Ohio? Was it a bail hearing? And because the judge thought she was being disrespectful, in answer to his question, she said yeah instead of yes, and he tacked on $2,000 to her fine. Like, come on, like, it's too arbitrary. It's too arbitrary and a little bit naive for us to think that a person in a position of power, given that much power, either be it. And I have my one of my brothers is a lawyer and was at one point an ADA. So, like, I have folks in the military, and I'm going somewhere with this, but I have folks who are in positions of power in government, well, in the military, which is a branch of government, and in law enforcement, I'll say that. And I understand, I'm not saying that because of this, I'm an expert. I'm not. It just take a step back and think on it. If you give someone, for the most part, if you give someone a lot of power and then you tell them, now don't rule on your emotions, you work rule specifically on the law, man, that's up for interpretation. Like, give me a break. Like, all of it is. And so the idea that the ultimate punishment, which is death, in my opinion, can be administered right there on the street and then no one be punished for it because it was an accident. Ain't that many accidents in the whole wide world. It's just not. Anyway, so our system is built on flaws. It's built with flaws in them, in it. And so for us to just assume that an authority is always right, even in a tough situation, and that they're above reproach is very naive and very much, well, that's impacting you, and so I can feel like this because I'm on the outside. But the minute you're on the inside, that viewpoint changes. It always does. So anyway, that's why it's easy. Well, anyway, I'm not going to go any further. But so anyway, so I was thinking about that when we had just at that point, the cries for Breonna Taylor had gotten louder. George Floyd had been murdered. And we were about to, as a country, start standing up and standing out again. So I was talking about just separatist organizations and wrapping my brain around. I was thinking about them and I was talking about them in those episodes because I was wrapping my brain around why a person would think that way. And for as much as we like to dog organizations who want to set themselves apart, as much as we want to dog religious organizations and non-religious organizations that want to do that, and we do need to scrutinize them, because, again, anytime you have an organization where someone's the head, You got to be careful about that. You have to scrutinize everything, because the reality of it is there are some wolves in sheep's clothing that are just out here to manipulate you. It's just what it is, right? And so if you're right to look at things, look at movements with a fine tooth comb, because we have to be careful what we put our energy toward, right? What we align ourselves with. We have to protect ourselves and be careful. And so anyway, but you know, the thing that they always accuse these separatist organizations that are not, and I'm not defending the ones that are racist and the ones that are, I'm not defending them, but I guess what I'm saying is it's easy to other them. It's easy to say, oh, well, they're all crazy. And you know, actually just to literally use the term, they're all crazy, and then be done with it. It's easy to say that than it is to confront the reason why they feel they need to separate. Now, mind you, when it comes to white separatist groups, I mean, they're separating because they don't want to, they're tired of miscegenation. What is it? Was it the mixing of the races? What is it? Yeah, the mixing of the races or what? Hold on. Now I need to know that term. Miscegenation. No, miscegenation. It's giving me migration because I'm probably spelling it wrong. Miscegenation. Nope, it's giving me imagination. Anyway, because the term that I am spelling it wrong. Miscegenation is with a Y, I believe. Miscegenate. Yep. No. Oh, it's miss, like miscellaneous. That's nasty. The interbreeding of people considered to be of different racial types. Why does that sound nasty to me? Because breeding is in the term, and it's interbreeding. Are they dogs? Like what? Anyway, anyway, gross. Not that people of different backgrounds and racial cultures, ethnic cultures, this word is nasty, and it's probably meant to feel nasty to me anyway, or just as meant to feel nasty. But no, so white separatist groups are you know, anti-miscegenation and you know, anti the rise of black and brown people in power and all that stuff, and they're definitely, you know, violent towards people who look like me. So I'm certainly not standing up in any way for them. What I am saying is that this culture that we all live in, well, American culture, I can only speak for American culture. This American culture that we live in is not all roses, baby. And it is as evidenced by the sheer number of people who live in poverty. The sheer number of people who live in poverty, the sheer number of people who are incarcerated for minor crimes, the sheer number of people who are incarcerated because they cannot pay fines. No one should ever be in jail because they can't pay a fine. The sheer number of people who are in poverty versus who are not in poverty, and then the 1% and all of that. Like this dream that we're living is a nightmare for many people. And I hate that I used, I don't know where that reference came from, except that I'm in Philly and I was not thinking of, I was not thinking of Meek Mill in any way, nor that song, even though I do love Dreams and Nightmares. But like, it's not roses. And the sooner that we all understand that, the sooner we can move forward and start making it a little bit more livable for everyone, not just some of us. But I mean, that's a pipe dream at this point, because folks who are in power tend to want to keep it. Folks who got money tend to want to keep it, which is why you see a lot of these people who are new money talking about, oh yeah, let me get on, you know, I want to keep my wealth. Don't you want my wealth? And start flaunting it and stuff, because they're not getting, it's ingrained in us that the minute we get wealth, it's time to turn around and show it. It's time to turn around and keep it and remind other people why they don't have it. And you know, that somehow or another you are blessed because you got it. Anyway, and more blessed than the person that doesn't have it is the other piece to that. So anyway, so I understand why people want to separate from society. This thing ain't what it's cracked up to be. It's an illusion for many of us, success. It's elusive for many of us. And so, yeah, but nevertheless, every day somebody ascribes to come to the United States because the situation they're leaving is worse than this one that they would be coming to. And in fact, they don't think of it as, you know, their situation is worse than what it is here. They're thinking, I have an opportunity here and I want to seize it, right? So you can't deny a person who wants to come over here and is looking still at the United States as a place where they can live and thrive, right? Or any country that you want to go to live and thrive, despite all the problems that its citizenry have with its own government, right? So two things can be true at once. So anyway, but I do understand why a person would want to separate, although separate because of cultural, not even cultural, the white separatists aren't separating because of culture. They're separating because they don't want to be around black and brown people. They want a white society. That's something different. But I guess what I'm going back to my main point is that it's easy for folks in positions of authority to wield it, however, and in the case of when you're talking about separatist organizations, it is easy to just say, well, these separatist organizations are crazy, and then just ignore them because, I mean, isn't that what we do with people who living with a mental health condition as a society? Totally a different tangent, but that's what we do, right? So, like, that's why we use that term. They're, you know, it's meant to dismiss them and their behavior. But the reality of it is it's rooted in something. And it needs to be listened to, except for that racist part. That don't need to be listened to. That needs to be thrown away in a fire and forgotten in a fiery pit. It needs to die in a fiery crash. But anyway, but getting back to MOVE, it's clear that in the 70s and in the 80s, the way that MOVE was viewed by the Philly PD, by the public at large, was one more of these separatist organizations. This time it was a black separatist organization because many of the figureheads were black. But once you scratch the surface, and again, I don't know a ton about this. I only know what I learned from Let the Fire Burn and articles about the organization, and then I learned a little bit more in 40 Years a Prisoner. But I don't know a ton more. I don't know nearly as enough as what I would want to learn, especially from folks inside the organization. Now, the benefit of 40 Years a Prisoner is that they actually did interview MOVE members. And I think they interviewed 1, 2, 3, not including the subject matter's parents, but I think they interviewed 1, 2, 3, 4. They interviewed 4 people that were either MOVE members directly or connected to MOVE members, which was not a perspective that we got outside of court testimony or news media reels, right? In Let the Fire Burn, we got court testimony and news video reels. In 40 Years a Prisoner, we got let's sit down and let's be interviewed. And I guess the thing that I want to share about the movie itself. Hold on, let me put it back in, 40. The director of the film is a white person. He's white presenting. I don't know if he's white, but he's white presenting. Tommy Oliver, who is a Philly native, right? So he grew up, I don't know how old he is, but I can know how old he is. All I have to do is look. Let's see if there is an age here. Nope, not an age here, but anyway, but what it does say here is that he went to Philly and he's a Carnegie Mellon University alum, which here in Baltimore, they call it Carnegie, but most people I've ever heard say this last name said Carnegie. So I don't know which one it is, but here they say Carnegie. So Carnegie Mellon University. Anyway, but he's from Philly, right? So he's aware of this history, in the way that being born where you're born, you're aware of a lot of different things. Even if you weren't directly linked to it, you are aware of it because you were born where this thing happened, right? So anyway, so you have him, and so there's this understanding of this thing that's happened. And then there, he links up somehow, I don't know how it happens, and I don't know that we learn about it in the documentary, although, you know, what's the other guy? It's the duo. Everybody knows the duo. Tariq. But what is his stage name? Quest and Tariq, from the Roots, they produced it. And I don't know if all of the Roots produced it or if it's just those two, the front men that produced it. But obviously the Roots are from Philly, so of course they're going to co-sign this. But anyway, so, well, not of course, but it makes sense that they would co-sign it. But anyway, so you've got this Philly root to this documentary to begin with. And then you have the subject matter of this documentary, which is Michael Africa Jr., which clearly appears to be a guy in his 40s who was born to Michael Africa Sr. and Denise Africa. And their last name is Africa because everyone who was a part of the MOVE organization chose to take the last name of John Africa, which was the movement's founder. I talk more about John Africa in the episode I did back in the spring, but long story short, John Africa was an army vet who came back and wanted to live a more simple life and actually took some of the teachings that he had learned from some other folks. He wasn't too terribly educated, but educated himself and then began what was the MOVE organization, or at least grew what became the MOVE organization in South Philly, right? And so they had altercations before, and actually at the point of which this story picks up, to the incidents that led to the incarceration of Michael Africa Sr. and Denise Africa was that there was an altercation that happened in 1978. Before 1978, it was in the early 70s, that there was basically a series of conflicts between the MOVE organization, John Africa and the MOVE organization, and the Philly PD. The Philly PD stepping in to say, hey, you're disturbing the neighbors. You know, we need you to act a certain way. We need you to act a certain way and to be a certain way. And so there was a clash. And so, you know, there was growing hostility where they were trying to be, the police were trying to police their behavior. And, you know, it's also the 70s. So you have these organizations that are, you understand the term cult at this point, right? So what we've seen from cults is that they're not great as a society. This is the prevailing thought, that cults are not great, that separatist organizations aren't themselves great either. And how, you know, we need to crush them when we get an opportunity. And it feels like that was the stance that the Philly PD had taken. And so there began this combative relationship where the Philly PD was like, I need you to behave the way I need you to behave. And MOVE organization was like, nah, we want to separate from you guys. And as a matter of fact, we do not recognize you to be an authority over our lives, right? And so conflict, right? Especially you're living in the middle of the city. You would think it would be easier to live in the country and live a separate, you know, to live separated from society. But we have pure examples of that in the Branch Davidians where, nope, not at all. anyway, and I'm not defending the Branch Davidians. I'm not defending separatist culture at all. I'm not defending it. What I am saying is that there's a reason why people want to remove themselves from American culture. It's not great. And there's always this reaction when people do, when organizations do, when you organize, there's always this reaction from the government as an entity, from the state as an entity. And it's always violence. It's always violence. And so in this instance, you know, it was increasing progression of aggression. And so there was an incident in 1978 where the MOVE organization was going to be evicted. I think they were going to be evicted from their location in 1978. And so by this time, John Africa, who was the founder of MOVE organization, I don't know if he was arrested in this incident or an earlier incident where shooting had occurred and he was put away. He might have been put away in... No, he was put away before this. He was put away before this. But in 1978, there was one more altercation, but this happened to be the first major altercation where Philly PD came in and they were going to forcibly remove the MOVE organization members, and there a battle ensued. There's a conflict ensued. That's not a battle. A battle is when folks are in many cases equally matched, and they're fighting for supremacy. This is not what that was. The police were removing these members from the neighborhood because of code violations and probably neighborhood complaints too, let's be real. And in the altercation, a police officer died in 1978. His life was taken. Now, the MOVE members and their lawyers maintain that the officer's life was lost due to friendly fire. That is, police officers accidentally shot. Well, not accidentally, whatever. He died by the hands of the police, shot in crossfire by police bullets or whatever. The Philly PD maintained that the MOVE organization shot and killed this member. And so the courts found in favor of the Philly PD. And so six members, are convicted and go to prison. And among those six members are Michael Africa Sr. and Denise Africa. Denise Africa was pregnant in 1978 when she went to prison. Or was it 1970? Anyway, she was pregnant when she went to prison. And it was in prison. She was 6 months pregnant. Yeah, she was like six months pregnant when she went to prison. And she gave birth in prison. And so she gave birth to Michael Jr. in prison. And so the subject picking up. So this is where, for the most part, with a little bit of introduction and a little bit of fanfare, the story of 40 Years a Prisoner picks up with Michael Africa talking about his birth, actually going to see his father in prison, Michael Africa Sr. And it's turned out that what we learn very quickly is that Michael Africa Jr. Has, since he's been able to going to the prison to see his mother and father. And I forgot the name of the prison where his parents were being held, but obviously it wasn't in Philly. You had to take a drive. But he'd been making that drive since he was a child. And since he's been able to, you know, he's been fighting for the release of his parents. So essentially the documentary takes us on this journey where, you know, Michael Africa Jr. is going back and forth to the prison to see both his parents. And we're learning more about the bombing of the MOVE organization. Not necessarily the bombing itself. We don't really talk about the bombing itself because the documentary supposes that you already know this information, right? The documentary supposes that you know what happened on the events of the date of the Philly bombing that I've forgotten already. Hold on, let me go back. 40 years a prisoner. No, what I really want is... Shoot. What I really want... Yeah, actually, they don't even talk about what happened in 1985 because Michael Africa Sr. and Denise Africa weren't even there. They were imprisoned at the time of the bombing. So they don't even talk about that, but they do hint at it. They let you know... They presuppose that you've done some research already, but if you haven't, they give you little sprinkles of, obviously they tell you exactly what happened with, that led to, Mike Africa Sr. and Denise Africa being imprisoned along with four other of their, I believe it was four other, of the Philly Move members. But they don't go into the 85 bombing. Instead, what they do is they go in, they let you hear from Ed Randell, who was at one time a mayor. They let you hear the escalating and aggressive language of the mayor at the time, in 1985. They let you hear from prosecutors. They let you hear from defendants, or not defendant, well, definitely defendants, but you hear from lawyers for the defense. You also hear from reporters about that give you more context about how people thought about what people thought about Move and how they responded to them. And I guess the thing that I would say is that while I'm not totally satisfied with the more that I learned, like I want, there's still more information that we just don't know. While we were on this journey to understand whether or not, basically, in a nutshell, Michael Africa Jr. was trying to, he was advocating for the release of his parents. At the end of the documentary, his parents are released. 40 years a prisoner, right? Like, you kind of get the hint that somebody's not going to be a prisoner. And it turns out, I think if I did the math right, Michael Africa Sr. and Denise Africa were prisoners for more than 40 years. I think it was like 42, if I did the math right. They were released in 2017. Wait, one was released in 2015 and the other was released in 2017. Something like that. Well, or maybe it was less than a year apart from one release to the next. But by 2018, they were both released. They were released in by 2017, Michael Africa Sr. and Denise Africa were released to the care of their son. And, you know, that was a beautiful reunion that we got at the end, but that we also learned that all of those folks that were imprisoned behind the death of the police officer in 1978 were released in 2018, which is, you know, depending on how you look at it, if you're related to the family of the person that lost their life, you're probably mad. I don't know what I think, except that it's totally possible. It's totally possible that the police officer died by friendly fire. It's also totally possible that he didn't. I'm not here to defend that. I guess what I'm here for is it's clear that Move wanted to separate themselves from each other, from society, even in the middle of the city. And they felt it was their right to do that because what other resources did they have? It felt that it was their right to do that because why not? This is where we live. One of the members had the townhome, had two townhomes. And so they set up headquarters there. They had to live somewhere. And then that's where they lived, in South Philly. I also think that, again, when an organization is seen as a threat, the United States government tends to respond very violently to them. And regardless of what you think of, the Branch Davidians are a prime, fine example. we have more examples than that, but I'm just using them because in this context, they called, even in the documentary 40 Years a Prisoner, one of the attorneys for the defendants called, believed that MoveIn itself was a cult. I don't know that we know enough information about Move to label them a cult, because I don't know enough to throw that term around, that not that I'm anybody. But like, usually we have more information about their, and you know, the members' indoctrination into the cult, and you know, there's restrictions on whether or not they can leave, or they're shunned if they leave, all of that stuff. We haven't heard any of that, right? That's what we've been accustomed to hearing from, right? Like Jim Jones, that was a cult where, you know, like it that behaved like a cult, right? Where in many cases, you're ridiculed if you try to leave. You're ridiculed if you go against the grain of the cult. You want to shed all of your, like, I think the only through line is that they were shedding all of their trappings of the modern world to be a part of this to live this anarcho-primitivist way of life. But outside of that, I don't know. Like, nobody that was a part of it speaks as if they were made to be a part of the cult, or that they were shunned in some way if they did not subscribe to every teaching of the cult. Like, I'm not hearing that. What I'm hearing is that folks thought it was a cult, and so we treated it like one. They were different. They were perceived to be living in a dirty way. They were saying, and again, all you have is the video footage from people who are outside observers saying, well, these kids are running around naked and there are dogs everywhere and it's gross. And I'm like, and they're eating raw foods. And I'm like, okay. Like, some of this just feels like you are judging, but you don't know. Like, are the baby's bellies distended? And that's how you know that they're malnourished. Are they dirty? Like, help me to understand. We've not been presented, in my view, enough information to determine whether or not the MOVE organization was a bad organization or not, if it was a cult or not. What I know is that it was treated as if it was a cult. And what we also know is that at the time, there was a lot of distrust with the Philly police, the Philly PD. Because there were, you know, issues of police brutality. And what we know is that even after the 1978 bombing and the 1978 and even after the bombing in 85, there was even more distrust, especially among Black folks, of the Philly PD. And we do have the benefit of hearing from, an activist, a community activist at the time, who was able to put into context the escalating nature of what was happening between Philly PD and the MOVE organization. And, you know, it was outside observer that clearly didn't totally buy what the MOVE organization was putting down, but was definitely recognizing the combative nature, the combative stance that the Philly PD took on. And so anyway, a lot of this is, I appreciated the context, but I still did want more, because it still doesn't tell me how it got to the point where it got, where not only did, because here's my thing. If you think this organization and many of its members were responsible for killing a police officer, if you truly believed that, then why didn't you, with all your might, crush the organization or at least force them out of the city? It was the same mayor. It was the same mayor. It was many of the same leaders in place from 78 to 85. It was many of the same leaders in place. So if you thought that they were a dangerous organization, why didn't you push them out of the city? Why did you allow them to thrive and grow in 85 to the point which you then needed to have a confrontation with them? Now, there's an argument in the Let the Fire Burn documentary that said that some members of the MOVE organization wanted to wanted to, pick a fight with Philly PD to escalate the situation and end it once and for all. In the 40 Years a Slave, the 40 Years a Prisoner movie, or documentary, the argument is that they were still being peaceful, but they were responding. They were responding to Philly PD, and their increasing acts of aggression. The truth is somewhere in the middle, I'm sure. I'm sure that the MOVE organization members were fed up with being harassed, and you kind of hear as much in their tone that they take when, you know, it was supposed to be really taboo, and I guess it's taboo today too, that they're cursing on live TV. It was probably more taboo back then, when respectability politics just as a whole were heightened. We even hear a reporter talking about a black reporter taking a stance against MOVE, saying, you know, if you just, no, not even MOVE, but like people who were frustrated with MOVE's treatment, which you didn't see in Let the Fire Burn. You didn't see the neighborhood and other black folks that weren't in that neighborhood, but were in Philly coming in support of MOVE. What you saw was neighbors being displaced and being frustrated that they were being displaced and not told anything. But you mostly just heard newsreel footage from MOVE members and then police reel footage. And then that's kind of how it went back and forth. And then you got the context of the documentary, the producer themselves or the director themselves. But yeah, so it, like I said, 40 years a prisoner paints a bigger picture in terms of the MOVE organization was a separatist organization, but they were being antagonized by the Philly PD. And again, I feel like I have more questions than I have answers in terms of how it escalated to the point where it did, especially if the thought was that MOVE organization members killed a police officer, but were allowed to thrive and grow again and rebuild in Philly. How did that happen if you thought that there was such a big threat, unless they weren't that much of a threat at all and it was about you showing your political power, is I guess my point of view. And it was advantageous for you at the time to seem like you were stronger and mighty and all of this stuff. I don't know, but yeah, I ultimately enjoyed the documentary because at the end of it, we learned that those MOVE members in the 70s were released, but we still don't really get any, like, what happened, like, what's happening in the area now? What reform, or was that the point of the documentary? Was it just the point of the documentary to add more information to the story? Because clearly we don't have any resolution other than those members are out of prison now. But I'm wondering, I know there's more there, and I'm wondering where we're going to get it from, because there's still members that were a part of the MOVE organization from the 80s. They're still alive and they're still talking and they're still going by that name. Like I said, I think I may have said, I can't remember, but they were Sue Africa and I think Hector Africa were interviewed for this documentary. Sue Africa is a white woman and Hector Africa is a Latinx member. And I think one of the reasons why it was important for the documentary, the documentary to include their voices is because it was probably perceived by many and certainly wasn't totally clear to me that the MOVE organization itself was not a black organization. It was not a predominant, it was a predominantly black people were in it, but it was black, brown, and white. The idea was one of the ideas that they espoused was that they were anti-racist, which how can you not get behind that? But again, maybe it was just part of the package where they were just like, I don't know what y'all are doing over here. That made people feel like, I don't know, but it was just, it was good for me to see that, you know, there were members that weren't black were talking about the benefits of this organization and what it meant for them. But yeah, it's just hard for me to understand why this escalated to the point where it did. and how only now is it being truly recognized in Philly by leadership that it happened. Now, mind you, in many cases, it's political reasons. Let's be real. Politicians are going to be a politician. And so, you know, it's politically advantageous in a predominantly Black city for anyone in leadership who wants to maintain it to recognize certain negative actions that happened against Black folks. It's just, that's the name of the game. That doesn't mean that you agree that things need to change. It means that you are a savvy politician. And that seemed very, very pessimistic. And I'm feeling pessimistic at this end of the year because, you know, even as we're accepting a new administration into the government, let's be real, it's not going to be all peaches and cream. And there are already issues with both of the incumbent leaders, both of them. And I know that I know I'm not the only one that's thinking this. And just because we Greek and all of that stuff, and, you know, just because we might be a part of this, we're a part of the same political party, doesn't mean that we agree, baby. I mean, I'm going to still be side-eyeing you. I'm going to just be side-eyeing you a little bit less than I'm side-eyeing the outgoing administration. But anyway, it's good information. It's good information to add, good context to add to that, to the story. I do want to hear more. Like, there are more children. There's actually a child. I thought his name was Africa. Honestly, the reason why I watched 40 Years a Prisoner is because I thought the subject for the movie, the subject for the documentary itself, was a child that was a focal point of the Let the Fire Burn documentary, because he was rescued from the house. And so I thought the guy, Michael, Africa Jr. was the child that was rescued from the house, but come to find out he wasn't. And I really wanted to hear from him, because ever since I first saw Let the Fire Burn, I wanted to hear what happened to that child. Where is he now? He's got to be in his 50s now, or approaching 50. Maybe he's like 45, 46 now. Yeah, because he was like 7 or 8. He was between 7 or 9 in 1985. So yeah, he's not old right now. So I want to hear from him, but maybe he doesn't want to be heard from. Anyway, but I'm glad that it added to the what we know about what happened there, because quite frankly, we're not talking about it enough. And we still think that things are bad now. We still think we have kids that are growing up thinking that things are bad now, more terrible than perhaps they were before slavery ended, or maybe, you know, Jim Crow. They haven't been this bad in a while, and that's just not true. It's just not true that police brutality has went away for a minute. That's not true. It has always been a present. It's always been a constant. And I think the more that we talk about stories like this, as far as heartbreaking as they are, because certainly children's lives were lost in these incidences, both in 78 and I believe in 85, children's lives were lost. And then, of course, just like, well, I won't compare them anymore. But again, in many cases, authorities are blaming the loss of those children, the loss of the lives of those children, on the members themselves, instead of the actions that were escalated, the situation that was escalated by the actions of the authority figures. And so it's messy, but we need to keep talking about it. We need to keep learning about it. So I appreciate this documentary for what it was, even though I still have more questions than answers. Anyway, I do encourage you to watch it. This thing came out on September 21st, but for whatever reason, it didn't come to HBO. It didn't come to HBO until, no, September 17th, but it didn't come to HBO until this last weekend, something like that. Anyway, it's gotten 88% rotten. It's 88% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, 6.4 out of 10 on IMDb. I don't even know how IMDb rates anything. And then 86% of Google users like this movie for whatever it's worth. And I'm among one of them. I'm among them. I enjoyed this because it added information, even though I want more. Watch this thing. What I will say is that watch this thing because it's interesting. And it, like I said, it adds more context to this conversation. And it's a feel good at the end because you get this poignant moment where Michael Africa Sr. and Denise are reunited for the first time. They hadn't seen each other in over 40 years. And that embrace brings tears to your eyes, obviously, around all of their grandchildren, because they're released to Michael Africa Jr. And so he's had a ton of kids and things like that. And so there's a house full of kids. And then they're in his backyard, which is a garden and all of that stuff. And they're sitting in the backyard and just able to enjoy. And you see them holding hands and stuff. And I appreciated it because I thought it was beautiful. That was heartwarming to me. So watch this documentary. And let me know what you think. Let me know if there's more information that you know. If you're from Philly and you have a different perspective on it, I'd love to hear it because, again, all I really have are a few articles, newsreels, and these movies, these two documentaries. So I would love to learn more. And while you're interacting with me, again, you can click the link. If you're not familiar, you can click the link in the show notes and it'll take you to a page where you can literally click a button and you can leave me a voice message and I'll get it. I may not answer it right away, but I'll get it. Definitely you can leave me a voicemail and you can donate to my page while you're there. Even 99 cents will be a helpful contribution. But again, I think the biggest help that you can be for me is to share this episode with somebody that you think might enjoy it, or any of the episodes that I've talked about this today, or any of the shows that you think might be interesting. If you just share those with your friends and family as a means to kind of help spread the word about this thing. At the end of the day, the more people that are listening, the more people that are liking and favoriting this thing, the broader my reach will be. And the more conversations that I can have. And I can keep this hobby that I've been doing for the last 3 years going. So thank you in advance for any help that you can provide. And just thank you for listening. Again, I say this all the time as a joke, but it's probably true that some of you are listening while you're doing a task, a mundane task. And I appreciate that because you could truly be listening to anyone as White Noise. You literally could be listening to White Noise while you're doing this task, but you chose to listen to this podcast, and I appreciate you. So enjoy. There's a winter weather advisory here in Baltimore. So if you're in and around the Metro Baltimore area, be safe. If you're not, just stay warm anyway and stay healthy, stay well, get the vaccine if you choose. Stay healthy and well, even if you don't choose to, because that's not what you want to do. Just make sure you're taking precautions and you're staying healthy and you're staying well, okay? All right, thanks for listening. Until next time.